There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I'd like to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
The selection of Sergio Aguero in the Man City team on Saturday against Chelsea and his subsequent mishaps put me in mind of a famous passage from Paul Rowan's book, The Team That Jack Built, in which Jack Charlton outlines his reasons for picking an ageing Liam Brady in the team for a friendly match against West Germany at Lands End Road in September 1989. So what I want you to do, Second Captain's podcast listener, is imagine it's Pep Guardiola uttering these words. All you need to do is, in your mind, get Pep's voice in your head, and you hear the word Ireland. Just replace it with Man City. When you hear the word Liam, replace it with Sergio. You ready? Murph, you ready? Ken,
yeah,
you ready?
I'm ready.
Go for it now.
With Ireland, you see, they don't give up their fucking heroes easily. So you've really got to show them. If I don't pick Liam, Sergio, to play, they want to know why you didn't fucking pick him to play. And you say, well, he's too old. He's not fast enough now. I want somebody who can do better for us in the years to come. I've got to reshape the side. So what I did was I put him on display. I put him on display to the public, and it was obvious that Liam had had his day. Brady gets substituted after 33 minutes. In my opinion, he was gone. He had a bad leg for a long time. He just wasn't the fucking Liam we knew and loved. The supporters would expect me to call him up for every match, in spite of the fact he's not quick and he's not playing. So I put him on display. And then after that, Liam disappeared off the scene. Okay, you can get Pep's voice back out of your head now and come on in to Monday's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Sergio, you're back, Murph. You're back, Ken.
Yeah.
It's Owen speaking
now. It's like I never left, Owen.
It's very, very much like you never fully got into that, Murph. But that's okay. As long as a few of our listeners did. Sergio lasted a lot longer than Liam on Saturday, 70 minutes. But it was a four-minute spell in the first half where the damage was done. First, the remonstrating with Raheem Sterling over Sterling's goal, even though Sterling just... You know, to be kind, did what had to be done after Aguero's awful first touch. To be less kind, maybe saved Aguero, who might have squandered the chance at that point. Then there was the Panenka, of course, not Sergio Aguero's finest moment. Albeit wasn't worthy of the apology that followed, I would like to apologise to my teammates, staff and supporters for missing the penalty. It was a bad decision and I take full responsibility. I don't think Liam Brady ever apologised for his performance against West Germany, nor should he. And I have to say, Ken, nor should Sergio Aguero apologise to Man City supporters after everything he's done for them, for trying and failing to score a penalty, even though, admittedly, it always looks pretty stupid when those ones don't come off.
Well, I agree with you, Owen. To apologise for that, I felt so sorry for the man. Yeah. I thought, how can you do this much for a club and be reduced to such a sad sight just at the very end?
Well, he was put on display. I mean, that's what it was, you know? Pep went down the Jack route. He said, so you want Sergio? I don't know if anyone, are Man City fans all calling for Sergio Aguero to stay? I don't know. I think at this point, maybe it's Sergio, you've done a lot for us. No need to apologise. And thank you for the memories. But I think we can all go our separate ways. By the way, when I went looking for the details of that Liam Brady substitution, I stumbled across this piece from the RT TV archives. This is a report from the day after that match against West Germany in 1989, 7th of September that year. It's an RT news report. It's just quite interesting how cutting Jack Charlton is, even in the day after, with emotions still running high, the day after substituting Brady. This is a report by Michael Lally from South Hill in Limerick. The footage in the first 30 seconds or so is of Jack mingling with locals, a lot of youth teams and so on. Lots of shots of teenagers kitted out in Ireland tracksuits, or in the case of a women's team, the full West Germany kit, which looks pretty cool. So Jack is in full joshing with the public and cuddling babies. Literally, he is handed a baby at one point during this before he gets down to business and starts answering the reporters' questions.
Jack Charlton, fresh from last night's match and the controversial taking off of Liam Brady, came to Limerick South Hill today to meet the young sports people of the area where unemployment is running at 70%. South Hill's Limerick Connection is the unique sporting and social club run the area in association with local community Gardaí. Jack wished them well as they prepared for a Welsh sporting tour. But how did he feel the morning after the taking off of Liam Brady in last night's match?
I left it a little bit longer than I should have done, really. Liam was struggling to get through the game at the pace that I wanted to get through the game, and I left it. And after half an hour, I thought, no, enough's enough. Because we were losing control of the game at that time, and how to do something about it.
Even people like Johnny Giles have said, a reporter have said, that it was an unfair decision.
Well, it's a decision that you've got to make. It would have been unfair. I should have done it after about 15 minutes. But I did it after 30. If I'd have left it any longer, I would have put the game at risk. And there were 43,000 people at the game, and there were a television audience of a few million who wanted us to win the game and get a result. And we were disintegrating in midfield at that time, and I had to do something about it.
How do you feel about Brady's decision to opt out of international football now?
Well, it's not really Liam's... I'm sorry that he's done it today. I thought he'd left it a couple of days before he announced it. You know. But he's done it today. I'm sorry that Liam's... decided not to come with us, but it's not his decision. If I want him again, I'll ask him.
I mean, I should have done it after 15 minutes. It's like, oh, Jack, that's a huge amount of sensitivity there.
God, like, and you have to remember just how good Lee Brady was for like 15 years for Ireland. So cold-blooded. It's some of the most cold-blooded stuff.
And the little one at the end, yeah. And you can't really see the grimace when John Giles, and you know, John Giles' opinions on the matter are mentioned. And then at the end, he's essentially saying, "Well, it's not Liam's decision to opt out. You know, I broke up with him. He didn't break up with me."
Yeah, I kind of showed the nasty side of Charlton there. Like, you know, the only other manager I can remember saying something as ridiculous as that was Mourinho claiming that. Within 10 minutes, simply 10 minutes of watching, you know, an 18-year-old making his first appearance in football told him everything he needed to know about that player's chances of making it and having a career. You know what I mean? I know after 10 minutes whether it's going to work out for the guy or not. And of course, invariably, it doesn't in Mourinho's head. The idea, you know, that after 15 minutes, you've seen enough to know that it's all over for Liam Brady.
Well, you know, in later years, when he talked to Paul Rowan a few years later for the book, he made the point he knew before the game that it was over for Liam Brady. He just had to show the public that.
Yeah, but, you know, again, like, why are you saying that? Because we've just conceded a goal to the team that's about to become the world champions. That was the reason, I guess. I mean, the match finished, I think, 1-1.
They conceded. Yeah, Ireland went ahead, then conceded an equaliser on the half hour, and then 3 minutes later, Brady was taken off.
Yeah, so Brady got blamed ridiculously. I mean, it was just, it's as clear a case of scapegoating as, you know, and then the way he says in that, you know, well, you know, I mean, it's sad that he sort of decided not to come with us, but I suppose it is his decision. Okay, yeah, fair enough. So, you know, I suppose managers have to win his decision.
While he's also saying it's my decision. He said it would have been better if Liam had waited a while. But I think Liam Brady was within his rights.
Better if Liam had waited. Waited a while, Jack. But I mean, the whole point there was getting rid of the person whose team it really had been over the previous several years. You know, I mean, it was Liam Brady's team. He was the major figure associated with the team. Certainly after John Giles stopped managing it. It was Liam Brady was the main man in the team. So when Charlton came in, he was like, I'm now the top guy. And certainly after Brady missed the Euros because of his red card or whatever. And then he decided, well, you know, you've got to go. So, where are we? I suppose there is a comparison with Guardiola and Aguero in that, you know, he was the star when Guardiola arrived. Guardiola didn't pick him. Guardiola wouldn't have picked him. And now he's leaving. Guardiola's way of handling it is different from Jack Charlton's. He's a bit more polite about it, but actually, arguably, maybe even a little worse. Colder about it. Yeah, I mean, at least Brady knew where he stood with Charlton. Like, he didn't.
Yeah, there was a directness. Yeah,
he didn't have to bother being nice about it. Like,
yeah,
you know,
Pep found out on Wednesday night that or Sergio Aguero found out on Wednesday night that he'd retired a number of years ago.
Him and Joe Hart were now.
Yeah, Joe Hart, the former players were being thanked by Pep.
David Silva, Sergio is, I believe, still with us.
But I thought that the apology was really interesting because there's no way a player should be apologizing for missing a penalty, especially in a game like that. I mean, I don't know, like if he's just missed a penalty and they've got relegated as a result. But you know, this is like a penalty at the end of the first half. They have further chances to win the match. The match itself, the result is not that consequential. I mean, the result is you know, it's you can tell how important the game is by the fact that Pep has picked the B team and Aguero was playing. Mm. You know
if
what
it
I
was
mean?
Really important, he wouldn't have been playing.
He wouldn't have been there. Exactly. You know, he's missed much bigger penalties in the past, but for some reason he feels as though he has to apologise for this. And I feel as though it was you know,
it's
Guardiola
because it was
left
the Panenka. Yeah. You say you feel Guardiola left him well?
I think Guardiola leaves him isolated, you know what I mean? Yeah. I don't think he really feels supported. I mean, he knows he's not. Like, he knows he's on the way out, but I just thought it was remarkable. So close to the end of his career that he's apologizing in this way for just a mistake that happens, like missing a penalty. Like missing a Panenka is no worse than missing any other type of penalty, apart from the fact that it kind of is worse.
Ked, you were going so well.
Yeah, but it isn't really though. It just looks,
it's not
it
worse.
Just,
I mean, it's like you either score a penalty or you don't. Yeah, like that's just the reality of the situation, you know?
So, yeah, but it's I don't know. It was a weird game.
Aguero can rest assured Man City are still going to win the league regardless, but loads of interesting stuff happening around Europe. Still up in the air in Spain after the top four all drew with each other over the weekend. PSG dropping more points in Ligue 1. In Italy, Juventus, who were going for 10 in a row this year, they're not even going to make the Champions League places as things stand after losing 3-0 at home to Milan. So I'm going to chat about that one with James Horncastle, just about what exactly is going on at Juve, who are also one of the clubs, by the way, still clinging on to the European Super League idea. There's some really good stuff coming up on the World Service over the rest of this week, including a brand new episode of The Game That Changed My Life tomorrow with a legend of Irish athletics, a four-time Olympian and three-time world indoor champion, Marcus O'Sullivan.
Marcus O'Sullivan, and he goes by Evanscott holds him up. He'll take him wide to the turn. That will cost Marcus about three more strides, lengthening the race. And here comes Marcus O'Sullivan. He's got him. He's out in front, and he beats him just by half a stride. 3:39.05 unofficial.
And he's still O'Sullivan in front, the champion in 87, the champion in 89. Will he do it again? But Strang is fighting back. It's O'Sullivan, Strang, Great Britain and Zorko, followed by Holman, America. And O'Sullivan strikes for home to win the world title for the third time. The silver for Great Britain and Strang, and Zorko in fourth place. A fine run by the veteran Irishman, O'Sullivan. Three world titles.
Yeah, those are the first and third of his world titles, 1987 and 1993. He spent much of his life in the US, in and around Villanova, the university where he ran himself and where he's been coaching for more than two decades. He's been head coach. But we can confirm, Murph, that Marcus's essential corkness remains intact, in case anyone's worried about that.
Well, it's one of those great chats as well where, as he starts discussing things that happened in Cork, his Cork accent appears. And then it kind of disappears into the background and then reappears when Cork gets mentioned again. But yeah, I mean, listen, Marcus has achieved plenty and we're going to get stuck into most of it tomorrow.
He's a fantastic, fantastic talker as well. So that's on the way tomorrow. There's loads of other great stuff coming up in the next few days. You can become a member now if you're not already on secondcaptains.com. It only costs a fiver a month plus VAT. So why not, eh? Why not? Report on sport, please, Ken. In fact, I might kick you off, Ken, with an email while we're on Man City, because I don't want to forget this one. It was an interesting... Declan Kelly is the person who sent it in. Dear Second Captains, on Thursday's football show, a listener put forward the preposterous claim that Kevin De Bruyne is underrated. This is true for non-members. David White emailed this in last week. In the interest of balance, allow me to advance the even more preposterous claim that Kevin De Bruyne is, in fact, overrated.
That wasn't a Man City legend, David White, was it?
I don't. Oh, yeah, no, I don't know. I did not say. I do so with no little trepidation, like I'm about to tell some parents that their only son, the apple of their eye, has just been found with a kilo of heroin in his school locker. But the Kevin De Bruyne propaganda machine has motored on for long enough, so it's time to do a Mrs. Doyle and take a screwdriver to it. One example of that machine in operation occurred during the second leg against PSG. As De Bruyne was being substituted, the commentator on the perfectly legal stream I was watching said he was outstanding as ever. Throwaway comment, perhaps, but by my reckoning, he was City's second worst player on the night behind Bernardo Silva. De Bruyne has been described by pundits as the best midfielder in the world. The nuances of Pep's system can, of course, be debated, as well as the nuances of what exactly constitutes a midfielder, but De Bruyne essentially functions as City's forward whenever a big game comes around. The reasons for this are manifold, perhaps the most obvious being Pep's general contempt for the idea of the striker, with the second most obvious being Pep's particular contempt for the strikers he actually has. But one of the reasons for this system, I venture, is that Pep, rightly to my eye, thinks De Bruyne has a couple of flaws that are exposed when he plays in midfield and that in turn expose his team at the highest level. First, a tendency to misplace relatively easy passes, leaving City vulnerable to counterattacks. And second, he does not excel in those small spaces that Pep goes on about, and so is not press resistant in the way that the very best midfielders tend to be. And for the record, I agree with Ken and Kieran. David Silva is not among those very best. De Bruyne lacks the quickness of feet and subtleness of body movements to thrive in congested areas. Contrary to one pundit's description of him as technically perfect, De Bruyne does lack technical qualities, and perhaps this is clouding my whole judgment of him, but it just so happens that one of those qualities, the ability to play in small spaces, to find a way out of sticky situations with a clever flick or piece of misdirection, is the one I find personally most compelling. It's a propaganda. It's a long one, but I'll keep going. I mean, I think it's nonsense, but I like the thought that's gone into it. A friend of mine recently likened De Bruyne to Steven Gerrard. The comparison is not perfect, but it's interesting to note that both Pep and Rafa have felt it necessary to push De Bruyne and Gerrard further forward, not only to maximise their virtues, but also minimise their vices. Those vices rarely get mentioned in De Bruyne's case, but they do exist. As the propaganda machine kicks into overdrive, I've seen people talk about De Bruyne as a contender for the Ballon d'Or this year. Again, by my entirely arbitrary reckoning, he might just about squeeze into the top five Man City players of the season. Diaz, Gundogan, Mahrez, Stones and Foden all have strong claims for being considered superior performers. Indeed, in the case of Foden, I think he already is, or at least very soon will be, a better player than De Bruyne. So there you have it. Kevin De Bruyne found out tonight, nothing player, says Declan. With a little bit of a wind up at the end, but you know, he raises some points there during the email.
I mean, I don't agree with the email. What the one thing that strikes me about the case that's made in the email, which is interesting, is that that someone who thinks this way, I don't see how you don't also think David Silva is amazing. You know what I mean? Like, if you're saying, like, literally all the things that you're kind of saying are missing from De Bruyne that you think he's not quite top are the things that David Silva is all about. You know, playing in tight spaces, not losing the ball under pressure. And that's literally...
Press resistant.
Yeah, because if you're talking about just numbers... You know, like De Bruyne is like, what about these numbers? You know, if you're talking about numbers, like David Silva can't hold a candle to the guy. But, you know, if you're talking about small spaces, you know, now we're talking. And you're sort of saying that you also don't think, you also don't think David Silva's up there. So I am wondering who exactly it would be, if De Bruyne can't quite hack it as a midfielder. Like, the comparison with Steven Gerrard is interesting. It's one we've talked about before. I mean, not so much in recent years. I think more when De Bruyne first arrived, first kind of came through. It's like, oh, he's a bit like that. But, you know, I don't think that Steven Gerrard was played further forward because he couldn't play in small spaces. I mean, the reason that Benitez gave for playing Gerrard where he did, say, when he partnered him with Fernando Torres, was Gerrard has the strength to reach the second balls, which is a pretty prosaic thing to put down. But, you know, he was like a really good athlete who could get there to, like, you know, unpredictable situations, a loose ball, Gerrard's onto it and, you know, can shoot a goal from 20 yards or whatever. But I don't think it was because he couldn't play in small space. I mean, I think he could. It was that you couldn't rely on him to hold his position. if you played him as a defensive midfielder, or if you gave him defensive duties in midfield, he would abandon those duties. Like, he would rush forward and try to involve himself in an attacking move, and then the other team would counterattack through the hole. That's the reason that Benitez didn't like to use him in the middle, because what he wanted from his midfielders was to be quite disciplined in holding their position. You know, not that we want to talk about Gerrard, but that, you know, the comparison is made with Gerrard. I don't think Gerrard has played in, you know, not in central midfield for that reason. I don't think that's the reason De Bruyne has played there either. I mean, De Bruyne plays at the moment when I mean, he has been playing in midfield normally for Guardiola over the period of Guardiola's time at Man City. He's been playing as what, the free eight? This is the term that he gives. So basically is a kind of an inside right. So he's got a defensive midfielder behind him, David Silva, you know, off to the left of him somewhere, usually a fullback, or a winger on the outside. And De Bruyne spent most of his time in the kind of inside right channel, crossing to the far post, or, you know, running to byline and putting it across goal. You know, this is the sort of pattern of his play for most of his time there. So he has actually been a midfielder for most of his time, and that's changed this season. I mean, he still does it sometimes, but for all of the big games, Guardiola has just not been using his forwards anymore. You know, I mean, and how these guys feel about it, not great. I mean, Aguero's like, I'm sorry. You know, so sad. Like, how many goals have you scored for the club? And like, this is how it's ending. It's grim. But Sterling was the guy responding to his... Did you see that? Because obviously Aguero and Sterling had that row on the pitch. Or not really a row. Aguero seemed to be saying, you know, dude, I was going to get there. Like, well, I can't believe you, you know, why are you busting my balls? And Sterling maybe was pointing out, yeah, there was a defender right there. If I hadn't done it, you know, it wouldn't have been a goal. So hope you don't mind, but maybe next time don't take such a bad touch. I don't know if that's exactly what they said to each other, but it seemed to be the content.
Well, even after the match, I mean, Sterling was asked about that moment, and he said, well, look, basically Sergio's touch didn't really work out, so I had to knock it home. He was more than within his rights. It would have been a dereliction of duty to leave, because he was the one running onto it and he had the easier finish. Albeit the easiest finish of the lot was Sergio's original one, if he just kicked it in rather than taking this. It's like he couldn't decide whether to. It seemed like an obvious tap in with his left foot, but he sort of went for it with his right and seemed to confuse himself. And I can't even remember what foot he ended up using to try to control it.
I think, weirdly, for
somebody with who does definitely have quick feet in the box, and, you know, is more than adept at those finishes. I don't know. It could just be confidence, which he tried to restore by panenking the penalty. And
yeah.
Just a point on De Bruyne there, though. De Bruyne lacks the quickness of feet and subtleness of body movements to thrive in congested areas. He does thrive in congested areas in the sense that he gets out of those areas. Firstly, I think his body movement actually is pretty good. I mean, I think he's able to sort of shimmy away from players quite well. But also, he gets out of those congested areas through his unbelievable vision, where he has already seen the pass he's going to play as the area is getting congested, and he manages to release it before he's tackled. It's a different way than a David Silva might do it. He might hold on to the ball a little bit more and dribble around a bit and, you know, then release it. But there are different ways to get out of congested areas, and his ridiculous vision and then ability to pick those passes, I think, is one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's a different player from David Silva, because David Silva was never a runner of any kind. Like, you know, he's the kind of a little guy who buzzes around swapping the ball with teammates who are close by, whereas De Bruyne does play on a grander scale. I would say that's definitely true. In terms of he's a better ball striker than David Silva, you know, the kind of, he can play these unbelievable 40, 50 yard passes and crosses. And so he obviously makes use of these almost unique skills that he has. I mean, as he should. And he is a player who used to charge around the field a lot. I mean, he does that less since he plays for Man City, because they play this positional game. You know, when he was playing for Wolfsburg, he used to be running all over the opposing half of the field, tearing around, shooting from every angle. It was probably a more exciting game for him to play, in a way, you know, the kind of an all-action type of, like, a more simple, off-the-cuff kind of game. Whereas at City, he's got a more specific role. It's like, you get into this position and play this type of ball and do that over and over again. I mean, it has changed, as I was saying, this season, because all those guys, Aguero, Jesus, and Sterling, have all just been relegated to the bench now, pretty much, by Pep. Like, Sterling was the guy, even though himself and Aguero had the little incident on the field, responding to Aguero's apology tweet saying, oh, you know, come on, Hermano, we only have ourselves to blame, right? Although I bet they could both think of one other person to blame. But yeah, we only have ourselves to blame. But these guys aren't going to feature in the big games. Maybe Sterling will. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen with injuries and so on. But like it'd be amazing to see Aguero in the Champions League final at this point. Like, how is Aguero going to play if one or other team is leading 3-0 at some point? Mm-hmm. Then you might see Aguero, you know. But what is the formation that he does play? Well, he's been playing this kind of interesting, almost like a four-man forward line, but without any forwards. And in this, De Bruyne has changed his role, so he's no longer the sort of inside right midfielder with a striker ahead of him, you know, and the winger and the fullback. He's now playing kind of almost inside left, but as the furthest forward player. So rather than crossing, he does cross. I mean, for instance, the goal against PSG was a cross from that position, which ended up flying into the net. But he's also being asked to shoot a lot more off. I mean, which is, it's more logical for him to be there to shoot with his right foot. And he's been doing that. And also you can see him playing those types of ball. I mean, for instance, the position he's in to release Foden for the Mahrez tap-in, you know, the Mahrez tap-in at the back post. You know, this is kind of where he's playing in these games now. I mean, I don't think it's because, like, I think the line in the email about Pep's very particular contempt for the strikers he has is, yes, actually the key point here. Yeah. Like, in one sense, Guardiola, like, I don't want to say it's an ego trip that he's like, oh, watch the way I do it, you know, I'm going to do it without strikers. You know, because he's always had this sort of ideological commitment to the game of midfielders. You know, it's all, my ideal team is 11 midfielders, you know what I mean? And obviously, pretty much everyone else in football has always been like, oh, well, Pep, are you serious? Like, is there no role for specialized defenders, specialized strikers? But the kind of super specialized striker that Sergio Aguero is, which is to say, like, a brilliant finisher who does nothing else, it's just, it doesn't interest Guardiola. Like, it never has. Like, he's always, he's never liked Aguero.
Because
he can't leave. You can't leave him out. Like, he's scoring like a goal a game. You know what I mean? Like, his scoring record is phenomenal, and he's been a hugely popular player with the fans. I mean, as Guardiola keeps kind of fulsomely referring to, like, oh, his goal and is part of the history of this club. Nothing can ever match up to that. Even if we win the Champions League, nothing can match up to his part in our history. You know, these kinds of slightly over the top. Like, but so you're not going to, you know, I mean, you're not going to get rid of him, you know, in the sense that he's sort of too good. But I always feel as though it's been an uneasy accommodation with him and Guardiola. Now Guardiola's decided that he can go. I mean, obviously, Aguero is a player in decline at this point. I mean, what is he, 33 now? You know, it happens to everybody. But the sort of player he is, what I think is a more interesting case than Aguero is actually Sterling. You know, and what's gone on there? You know, why is he sort of seemingly being kind of sidelined a little bit? The other thing that I should say as well is, players do get sort of randomly sidelined under Guardiola and then can come back. Like, it happened to Stones. It happened to Bernardo. You know, Bernardo is a key player again. Stones is obviously the, you know, back in their main sort of lineup. Mahrez went through a spell where he was kind of out, and now he's, you know, is he...
Well, that's always going to happen if you've got tons of really good players.
Well, it isn't. I mean, it doesn't happen at Liverpool. It doesn't matter how badly Mane or Firmino play. But if you look at the example of Liverpool, like, he's basically been picking the same team for like 5 years. Maybe that's part of the reason why...
It's a point now that City have more depth. You know, City have... Phil Foden or Raheem Sterling, I'd be happy enough with either of those in my team on a given day. Do you know what I mean? Whereas there is a bit more of a drop off.
It's a more complicated squad to manage from that point of view, like in terms of balancing all the competing claims. I mean, Chelsea have that position as well, although they are they're still in the excitement phase. They're still in the honeymoon phase with Thomas Tuchel, so they haven't. I don't know if you noticed the Tammy Abraham bit after the game. No. Where Tuchel was, you know, Tuchel was on the field.
Yeah, he was very demonstrative with his players. What did he do with Tammy?
With one exception. it was like, you know, you're not going to lose your job. You're not going to lose your job. You're not going to lose your job. It was one of those types of things with Tammy. So he's not the biggest fan of T-Bone. But look, what can you do? You can't please everybody. Thomas Tuchel is it's two wins out of two against Man City now. And obviously it was a game where, you know, like City had dropped a lot of the players who you will expect to see in the Champions League final. But I thought Chelsea had done that as well to some extent. You know, I'm expecting to see Kai Havertz playing that game, and you know, he wasn't starting in this one. So they've got some tricks still left up their sleeves as well.
Brendan Rodgers, you want to mention Brendan before we wrap this report on sport?
How can I not? He is at the centre of one of the dramas.
I mean, you could try, Ked, but it's just not possible.
It is one of the great dramas of the season, is, you know, as Thiago was saying, the will we get this little miracle we're looking for? Thiago, after scoring his first goal for Liverpool, and this little miracle is perhaps being made possible by the stunning 4-2 win for Newcastle against Leicester on Friday night. And I just felt for Brendan Rodgers when I saw the Sunday Times, because it's an unbelievable gift that he has for doing this. And this one actually isn't his fault. What's happened here is that Leicester City, in case you haven't noticed, are contesting the FA Cup final next Saturday. Now, the Sunday Times, the thing about the Sunday Times is that it is a Sunday newspaper, and therefore the only chance for preview content for the FA Cup final is the preceding Sunday. And that, I'm guessing, is what Jonathan Northcroft was planning to do. And the fact that Newcastle, or Leicester rather, were playing on Friday night against Newcastle probably wasn't, you know, a major consideration.
If you were looking at that and you were Jonathan Northcroft, you'd say, I think I can go ahead and talk to Brendan Rodgers on Wednesday or Thursday and it's going to be okay.
It's not a straight interview with Brendan Rodgers. It's not a straight interview with Brendan Rodgers. It's just... but it is, he has on occasion in his career been in situations where a glowing write-up has appeared moments before an on-field pratfall. And on this occasion it appears actually after the pratfall. I mean, the famous one being when he personally took the initiative in saving Liverpool FC's season 2014-15, and this came out like the day that Manchester United drove a stake through the heart of said season. You know what I mean? And that was unfortunate. This one,
I do love the word pratfall. I used mishap earlier talking about Sergio. I should have gone for pratfall. That's not a word you hear often enough.
nobody really uses it these days. Confident, inspiring, and sensitive, the second coming of Brendan Rodgers. Straight talking Ulsterman able to turn down the biggest clubs as reputation soars. I mean, imagine Brendan Rodgers turning down the biggest clubs. I don't think that's going to happen. You know what I mean? I think Brendan Rodgers is a realistic guy. You know, ultimately, he showed that when he left Celtic.
Mid-season.
You know, it's like, you know, it's mentioned in this piece, aware that no one had ever left Celtic before. No one walks out on Celtic. He still did anyway, because he's like, look, you know, I mean, I'm taking them as far as I can. But I just wanted, just the first couple of paragraphs. One of the first meetings Brendan Rodgers held at Leicester City involved the club's cleaners. The corridor at the old training ground, Belvoir Drive, was partially blocked by a pile of boxes. Rodgers told the cleaners, "Your role is vital at this football club. It is you who look after the environment we work in. If you could find some way to move these boxes, it would be incredible." The cleaners were delighted. They had long wanted to clear the corridor, but were told that the boxes were important. "Do what you feel necessary," Rodgers says. "If anyone complains, send them to me." The cleaners felt 10 feet tall. So the cleaners felt 10 feet tall. Okay. I mean, that's an amazing story.
Time to engage with some back-breaking labor, cleaners. Get to it. Thanks, boss.
It's just an amazing story on so many levels. Like, who tells the story? Who said the cleaners were 10 feet tall? I mean, we don't know, but it is a fascinating slice of life, which I think does succeed in conveying a flavor of what things are like.
I would have thought you would feel 10 foot tall if you're working at Leicester and Brendan Rodgers invites you out onto the training ground, for example. Come out and have a penalty competition with Jamie Vardy. Well, that might just be too embarrassing. But you know what I mean? Have a kick around with the lads. That's what would make me feel 10 foot tall if I worked, you know, somewhere in the background at Leicester. Not basically, see the job, see the way those... that you're supposed to clean up that mess, and that mess is there. You really got to be cleaning up that mess.
It would be incredible if you did that. I mean, he's not asking them to do their job. He's saying it's incredible if you could do your job.
That's the point. He's not telling them. Yeah, exactly. He's making them feel like, yeah.
Have you ever done that, though, if you're at a restaurant or something, you sort of feel in a very polite mood or something, you slightly overcompensate with how delighted you seem to be. Like, you know, obviously everyone wants to be as nice and respectful as possible to the person who's taking their order, but like sometimes you can just go over the top and do a bit of a Pep Guardiola on it, like, you know, incredible incredible waiter,
incredible.
It would be incredible. That'd be amazing, thanks so much. You know, I've done that. I've done that. So maybe that's what Roger's doing. But you know, what does the story tell you? It tells you clear line of command. You know what I mean? There's been a problem. The problem isn't just the boxes. That's just a physical manifestation of the problem. The problem is the unclear chain of command. It's like, we could move the boxes, but, you know, whose nose might be out of joint? You know, whose turf will we be straying onto here? Roger says, don't worry about that. I say, do what you need to do to move the boxes.
Liverpool are going to finish ahead of Brendan Rodgers here.
No, look.
They really are.
Like, there's a couple of other things in this. There's a couple of other things in this. I mean, before we move on to that, because there's something else going on there as well, which I think everyone is well aware of. But the his methods include tactical periodization. Again, I read from the Sunday Times, Jonathan Norcroft, Brendan Rodgers. His methods include tactical periodization, training that incorporates fitness work into tactical and technical drills, learned from Mourinho, who brought Rodgers from Reading's academy to Chelsea's in 2004. As a coach, he has everything, Andy King, the former Leicester midfielder, says. Organisation, being clear and getting his message across. It's not just, I want to play like this. He shows you, he teaches you how. Teaches you how. Well, I mean, that's what a coach is supposed to do, really, isn't it? I mean, usually when people say this exact thing that Andy King is saying, the word that they finish it with is not how, but why. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not just play passing football, blah, 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 blah. It's like, this is why we're going to do it. You know what I mean? This, so that you understand, oh, I get it. I get, that's why we did, that's why we don't just lump it out from the back. I get it. I see now. You know what I mean? But in this case, it's just, he teaches you how. And you're like, well, of course he does. Like, I mean, what else would he be doing? Like, what? Like, just sort of coming out by the side of the training field and saying, lads, you know, I want you to pass it out from the back today. Slick interplay. I want to see lovely combination moves all the pitch. I want triangles, lads. You know, I want you to go out there and absolutely play them off the park, lads. And then just goes back into his office. Like, that's, you know, that... there's not many managers who can still get away with doing it like that. A core Rodgers principle is his players are never too young to trust and never too old to learn. He rejects the old British orthodoxy that you have to choose between winning football and development football. Rodgers' colleague says winning mentality within a development culture is his ideal. It is why he has inspired older players as much as young ones. From Gary Monk to Steven Gerrard to Scott Brown to Jamie Vardy, the ability to get inside players' heads is demonstrated by the blossoming of Kelechi Iheanacho. A talent whom Claude Puel once drove to tears at training is transformed in terms of happiness and confidence and been taught sports psychology tips. Well, that's good, and certainly Iheanacho has been the sensation of the second half of the season. Although I can't help but feel that simply putting him on the field might have been the key move in getting this better goal return out of him, because by like February, Iheanacho had made two starts in the league. He literally had two starts before February. His first 90 minutes After that was also his first goal, and he's got 11 goals in 12 games since then. So I'm just wondering if maybe he might have actually played a little bit of a more significant role at a slightly earlier stage. The big question, Kieran, as you said, is are Leicester going to cling on? Are they going to do it?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Maybe the answer to that question lies more in Manchester United's hands than...
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, that's there's this bizarre situation.
Yeah. No, I'm only looking at Leicester's last four games of the season, which are Man United tomorrow, then the FA Cup final against Chelsea, then Chelsea again away next Tuesday, and then Spurs at home on the last day of the season. So this is not an easy run-in by any stretch of the imagination, whereas Liverpool have four games left, obviously, United on Thursday, West Brom, Burnley, and Crystal Palace. Not good.
Yeah,
not good. I mean, if I was Brendan Rodgers.
No, it's not. I mean, West Brom are relegated. Burnley and Palace are safe. Burnley aren't officially safe. But I mean,
but by Wednesday week, they will be.
So
Leicester have a cushion. Just say points wise, just for people. So assuming Liverpool win their game in hand, then Leicester are still 3 points ahead. But by that point, the goal difference would be. The advantage they have would be just about wiped out because there's only two in it at the moment.
So the problem is that Manchester United, who they play tomorrow, also have to play Liverpool on Thursday. Now, if you're Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, which game are you going to prioritise? I think it's quite clear which game you prioritise. I mean, one of these games matters more than the other game. Neither of them really matters in the sense that Manchester United have already guaranteed Champions League qualification. I mean, the Leicester are the only one of these two teams that can finish ahead of United, but it's not a major consideration in terms of the top four is guaranteed. The priority now is to win the Europa League and to avoid injuries. I mean, Harry Maguire had an injury yesterday, which they don't know yet how serious it is. Solskjaer said it could be a few days, or he could miss the Europa League final, which would be obviously considerably more serious. Leicester have already beaten Man United this season in the cup. I kind of feel as though United can't really be at full motivation for this. The only thing about it is that they will be, there will be players involved against Leicester who are hoping to maybe feature in the Europa League final. You know, it's literally here's your chance to show what you can do. But that's really what it is going to be. I'd be amazed if it was any other way because, you know, they played 2 days ago. You know, it's an insane piece of scheduling. The other question, though, has to do with, are these games actually going to happen at all? Are these games actually going ahead? That's the imponderable at this point. Or is there going to be another little surprise in store from Manchester United supporters? Because the last time Manchester United were supposed to play at home, that game didn't happen.
From 4-1 down, Bohemians have come back to beat Shamrock Rovers 6-4. 2 minutes and 17 seconds, that's all it's taken. Bounce with the penalty. Tony Grant. We've got 4-1 in front, and we've only played 39 minutes.
Lardner up.
Into the 6-yard line, and there's Nedovic with his first ever league goal for Bohemians. Back in the game.
Lardner up.
Resting through the centre is Morris.
Juventus were supposed to be closing in on 10 Serie A titles in a row by now if things had gone to plan. Instead, they're scrambling around trying to qualify for the Champions League after a 3-0 defeat at home to Milan. What the hell is going on at Juve? James Horncastle recovers Serie A for The Athletic these days, and he's on to try to answer that question for us. James, how are things?
Well, very good, Owen. Very good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, great to talk to you. So what is going on at Juve? How has it come to this?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here because this is the undoing project, really. I think if you look at the position that Juventus had got themselves in 3 years ago, which is when they kind of, I suppose, signed Cristiano Ronaldo, you would never have really envisaged them going into the final weeks of the season, not being sure of qualifying for the Champions League. You know, the strength of this club, at least under Andrea Agnelli in the last 11 or 12 years, has been stability. It's been what has been perceived to be very good, shrewd management for, let's say, 7 or 8 of the last 11 years. And the mentality that Agnelli and some of the coaches and players from Conte, Chiellini have been able to bring to the team. And gradually, that feels like it's worn down and it's just not there. And you've seen a series of decisions which I think have led to this point. But, you know, just to go to Sunday's game, it's not only the defeat that I think resonates really strongly. I think it's just the concatenation of things that are going on at Juventus right now. You know, be it their continued presence in the Super League, what sanctions that might bring from UEFA. We'll maybe learn more about that over the next week. The fact that their long-term sporting director, Fabio Paratici, his contract hasn't been extended. Cristiano Ronaldo, Paulo Dybala, their deals will be up in a year's time. So now is the time when you should be bringing those guys to the negotiating table and deciding what your future is going to be. And then there's, of course, Agnelli, who, you know, was one of the most influential figures in European football up until a couple of weeks ago, and now looks more isolated than ever before. And I think if you're on the board at Juventus, or if you're on the board of Exor, which is the holding company that runs Juventus, you have to ask yourself whether the club's interests are best served by him continuing as president of the club when he's, well, it looks like he's burnt his bridges with pretty much every sporting institution that Juventus have to interface with.
Yeah, he's got that surname though, James, which makes me think that his position is probably secure. But maybe, I mean, it's a complicated family, the Agnellis, I guess. I don't think he's not necessarily the direct line of succession from Big Gianni, is he? So he's a sort of an offshoot. Just how secure is his position? Who is he answerable to?
So this is one of the reasons why Sunday's game felt really significant, because his cousin, John Elkann, who is the head of the family, the scion of the Agnellis, he was present. He watched the game, sat next to Andrea Agnelli. And Agnelli essentially answers to John Elkann. Elkann is president of Exor, which is the family holding company. And Juventus, whilst it is significant from a cultural point of view, has great cultural capital, soft power, I suppose, even though really it's not used in the same way that the Qataris use PSG. It is a speck on the balance sheet of Exor. You know, it does not compare with Stellantis, for example, which is this conglomerate that they've recently put together, which has all the great Italian brand names in car making joining forces with their French equivalents. You know, Agnelli essentially performs a role for John Elkann, which is not too dissimilar to what Marina Granovskaya does for Abramovich, what Ed Woodward has done for the Glazers. It's that kind of relationship. And, you know, to be fair to Agnelli, he has done a very good job for 8 years in making Juventus relevant. Again, after Calciopoli, which shouldn't be taken for granted, and also for kind of getting himself in a position where he was a real figure of influence in shaping the European game. And of course, that has all fallen apart in spectacular fashion in the last fortnight. And I think that's the key to understanding Juventus at the moment, is this uncertainty around what's around the corner. Because I think for the first time, you don't know who's going to be president next year. You don't know who's going to be sporting director. You don't know who's going to be coach. And you don't know if Cristiano Ronaldo is going to be there. So it's very hard to understand what Juventus will look like from August of this year.
Well, Ronaldo is an interesting case. You know, I saw him at the end of the game sort of storm off. You know, he doesn't like storm. It's, I mean, he walked off. He walked off looking, you know, a little bit angry and a little bit disappointed. He wasn't sticking around. But do you think he has any interest really in sticking around? Because this move hasn't really worked for him. I mean, does he take any inspiration from Ibrahimovic on the other team and still doing it at nearly 40? Milan are going to be probably in the Champions League next year, and he's, you know, he's done a lot to put them there. He's still a few years older than Ronaldo. Does Ronaldo think, yeah, you know, maybe I could do that? Or do you get the feeling he's looking for one last challenge now, one last different challenge?
I think he must be, because, you know, from everything we're told about Cristiano, he thinks he can continue playing into his 40s. You know, I mean, he's in a bad season for Juventus, he's top scorer in the league. When other players have kind of made more headlines, like Lukaku, for example, and some of the other strikers in the league, yeah, Cristiano's still on top. And I suppose, unlike last year, hasn't contributed to his total with, I don't know, 10 or 15 penalties. He's often rescued them. But you have to say, I can't remember a season in which Ronaldo's put in more listless and anonymous performances. I mean, certainly last Sunday night was a case in point. He was totally ineffective. I think on the one hand, service or lack of it was a part of that. I don't think he particularly enjoys playing with this midfield behind him, which can't create, which can't make chances for him. And yeah, Cristiano's always measured himself by the Champions League. He understands that is where his legacy is. It's where he has made his name. And Juventus might not be a part of that next year. And either by not qualifying in the top four or because of some decision UEFA take. And I think that must bring reflection. I think he was already reflecting last year on his future when they went out in the round of 16 to Lyon. I think you can understand why he went there. And I think even though it hasn't worked out, I don't think anyone really can begrudge Juventus for taking that decision to sign him either. You know, they haven't won the Champions League, which is what he was brought to do. They'd reached the final in two of the 4 years before he got there, and he was the guy who more often than not either beat them in the final or knocked them out. So I think, you know, you could see from his perspective, he thought, right, all this team is missing is me. And Juventus thought that as well. And instead, they've just gone backwards. Quarterfinals out to Ajax, round of 16 out to Lyon, round of 16 out to Porto. Which is really, really humiliating, I think, if you are given everything that this project was built up to be.
You mentioned, James, I think in your opening answer, a series of bad decisions they've made. Is one of those bad decisions appointing Andrea Pirlo as manager?
Oh, undoubtedly. You know, I didn't know really what to make of this when it happened, because we knew so little of Pirlo, the manager. You know, I think from the sell that Juventus were giving, you know, they hoped that he would be like Pep Guardiola, like Zinedine Zidane, even though those guys had, you know, in Pep's case, had coached the Barcelona B in the second division. In Zidane's case, had Castilla, had served under Ancelotti. You know, Pirlo had no experience whatsoever, and a week before his appointment as first team head coach, was unveiled as their under 23 coach. So it didn't really seem joined up. I think I hope we're going to get the most fascinating all or nothing series on Amazon, because Juventus have had the cameras there all season. And what a season for that to happen, because, you know, everything that could go wrong has gone wrong. You know, I mean, I can imagine from an Amazon point of view, the idea of having Pirlo as coach or Pirlo involved would be appealing and attractive. Mm. And, you know, I think there is this feeling, you know, from what I can gather, I don't think this informed the decision, but you can certainly get this impression that Juventus have have kind of moved in the last 3-4 years, ever since the change of logo to being this kind of lifestyle fashion brand, entertainment company, when they've essentially lost sight of what really matters, which is what happens on the pitch.
Well, I think that's just such a typical thing that happens to football clubs, who don't realize that the kind of, you can't directly go for like being a lifestyle brand. You have to be a football club first, and then with this is the lifestyle sort of, the fact that you become cool is like is a happy byproduct, which you can't just snatch at directly. It's like missing the whole point of what you're meant to be doing. I wonder though if Pirlo, I mean, you know, you could say this was a good job for him to come into, but then again, you know, there's quotes going around today apparently from Maurizio Sarri from last year saying, sack me if you like, but this team is untrainable, and which is a bit of a head scratcher in one sense, because it's like, well, they can't be that bad, Maurizio, because they have won like all the leagues for the last decade pretty much. But what do you think Sarri is getting at there? Is it the case that this team was sort of old and calcified and incapable of learning, or what did he mean by that quote?
Well, I think, I mean, to go back briefly on this lifestyle point of view, I think they were very sensitive to trends in European football, which is, even when they were winning the league under Allegri, I think they were very mindful that in every press conference, even when they were winning the league, Allegri would get quizzed on, you know, what is good football. And good football was seen to be Maurizio Sarri's brand of football. It was seen to be in step with sort of changes in the game. It's why he kind of seemed to transcend Serie A for a little bit. Even, you know, casual Serie A fans, non-Napoli affiliated supporters would watch Sarri or Sarri Ball or whatever it was called. It became a Twitter thing. And they appointed him straight after Allegri. And they are two very different coaches who need, I think, two very different squads in order to implement their kind of ideas and their football. And, you know, this goes back to Cristiano. If you have Cristiano on the team, can you play a high-pressing intensity game when ultimately having him on the team is everything has to be focused through an individual rather than a collective? And I think that has changed the dynamic within Juventus over the last 3 years. I mean, this club that was very stable, you know, had Allegri for 5 years, Conte for 3. I think they would have kept Conte had he not resigned, because he complained that they weren't spending enough money and they would never be competitive in the Champions League unless they did that. They've gone through 3 managers in 3 years, and they'll probably be on their 4th, you know, in a few weeks. I think one of the interesting things about Pirlo is he, in many respects, shares a lot of the same ideas as Sarri. A lot of the ideas that I suppose you see coming out of German football, Spanish football, things that are, I'm not going to say un-Italian, but certainly removed from tradition in Italy. And Juventus is probably the most traditional, most Italian club. You know, I mean, their motto is winning isn't important. It's the only thing that matters. It doesn't matter how you win. You just have to do it. And yet all of a sudden, how you win became very important to Maurizio Sarri, became very important to Pirlo. It's like, yeah, we let's judge the performance, not the results. It's like, no, at Juventus, you are judged on results. And I think Ronaldo is, there's a catch 22 with Ronaldo. You have one of the two best players in the world, but the financial expense of having him, you know, in terms of the fee, in terms of servicing his kind of wages, it means that it's very difficult to then build around him as well, because you're constantly trying to kind of juggle things. It's like, okay, well, let's try and sell Gonzalo Higuain, get him off the wage bill. Oh, damn, we've just appointed Maurizio Sarri. He had his best ever season under Maurizio Sarri, so he's going to want to stay now. That's a problem. Let's sell Dybala then. Oh no, he doesn't want to stay because all of a sudden we've got Cristiano and everyone wants to train with Cristiano. All these young kids that we've signed to rejuvenate the team, they don't want to, they're the ones who've got resale value, but they don't want to leave because A, they think they can win things here, and B, they just want to train and learn from Cristiano. So it's a really kind of complicated dynamic that has begun to kind of take shape there. And aside from maybe try and move on from Cristiano and accept that, look, yes, he scored lots of goals and he's won league titles with us too. It hasn't worked out, and let's try and reshape the team on a more efficient, let's get more room for maneuver, let's say, by moving him on. I don't really know what they do.
Well, the solution that they had in mind until quite recently, and maybe still do, it was the Super League. And they released in the last couple of days a joint statement with Real Madrid and Barcelona, which I read the Barcelona version. I think it's the same from all clubs. I read it twice, and I still aren't really sure what it says. Like, there's so many words in it. There's stuff in it about like how they want to set up women's football. But I, at the end of it, I was kind of scratching my head going, are they backing off this or are they still clinging to it? Like, what is Juventus's position at this point, given that like everyone else or their other two Italian clubs seem to have left, all the English clubs, Atletico. There's only three of them left and you can't have a league. Well, you can have the Tri-Nations, I suppose. But apart from that, I don't know any other three-team leagues. This is like not going to happen. So what is Juventus's current position on that?
Well, I think Juventus' current position, and this has been consistent, is that ever since the Super League came into effect, Agnelli, in the kind of two interviews he gave, said that they're challenging UEFA because they think that UEFA is a monopoly, that it can't be a regulator and hold competitions at the same time. It's like Ofcom. Sort of the telecoms regulator in the UK basically saying, sorry, Vodafone, sorry, BT. But if you want a phone contract in the UK, you have to have an Ofcom contract. You know, this is the kind of thing that's in play here. Unless there's an appetite really for them to go full Jean-Marc Bosman and take this to the courts and be in a long legal battle, I think it's completely counterproductive for Juventus, because if you're outside of the Champions League, if you're banned from that, then you're going to limit how much money you can make, and you're going to have limited appeal to players. So I think that this has to get resolved. Also, because Serie A has, well, the Italian Football Federation has amended its licensing statutes. I don't know where you saw this. This was a reaction to the Super League, whereby if you sign up for a private competition that is not recognized by UEFA, FIFA, or the Italian Football Federation, then you essentially forfeit your right to play in Serie A, Serie B, Serie C, whatever it is. And so if Juventus were to stay in this Super League and remain part of this weird triumvirate that they've got with Real Madrid and Barcelona, and UEFA were to ban them, then the Italian Football Federation could quite feasibly ban them from playing in Serie A next year as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the stakes are incredibly high.
Yeah, and one interesting thing about it is looking at it, the behaviour of the two Milan clubs who backed off, and, they didn't show the touching loyalty to Juventus that Barcelona have showed to Real Madrid. Why do you think that is? Why did they? Because these clubs are in a lot of trouble. You know, if there was, there can't be too many more desperate clubs in financial terms in Europe than the two Milan clubs. You know, Inter are the champions, but apparently are losing money hand over fist. Milan, I think, have been losing an average of 100 million euros a year for 7 years, with like including 200 million last year, which is just, I have no idea how they lose so much with the team that they've got. It doesn't make any sense to me. I would have thought if you're ever going to have a pair of Super League diehards, it's these two teams, but they backed off.
Yeah, I think that was surprising. And that was one of the most interesting bits of the statement that the three put out, that they were, it felt like they were disappointed in the others for backing out. And from what I can gather, Milan were the last team to withdraw. And I was personally surprised by that because, I think Yeah, they are backed by Elliott, a hedge fund which isn't afraid of getting involved in sort of long legal disputes, and has a very good record of succeeding in them. I think it ended up being real politic for them. We can't go against this system. I think the surprising thing really is with Inter. And how quickly they were the first Italian to pull out. They more or less did on the coattails of the other Premier League teams. And Inter are in real financial distress. This talk this week that the president is finally back from China after 7 months. He's been trying to find an emergency loan for 250 or 300 million euro. He's going to have a very full and frank conversation with the players this week and Antonio Conte about cutting costs, about the players either foregoing a couple of months' wages or deferring some more wages. If the players aren't on board with that, then what happens? Do they sell some of their best players? Conte is not going to like that. Conte would you'd imagine consider his position in that case. So it's I think what's quite kind of interesting about this whole Super League debate really is that I think you can quite easily make the case in the Premier League that the big six were greedy. It was a power grab. It's very much kind of led by we want to kind of align with a more US style model as what we've seen in the NBA, the NFL. Of course, I think that appealed to the clubs in Southern Europe. But I do think the clubs in Southern Europe are desperate as well. Desperate in a way that, because they are the Premier League is a Super League by another name. The Premier League makes what, 5.5 billion a year. These leagues, even with these top clubs in it, make half that. And in Italy in particular, you've got infrastructure problems which kind of really limit teams from catching up. That can be, you look at San Siro, for example. The number of teams in Serie A that don't own their own stadium, have tried to build their own stadium, but haven't been able to cut through red tape in bureaucratic terms or just get backing for it. And that has held them back. That's one of the reasons why, sort of Serie A has really kind of fallen behind. And, it's been phrased like this to me before that Serie A, it's like the Christopher Nolan film Interstellar, you've got this dust planet that you're on, and you just need to get into a spaceship and find another place to live because the prospects there it's very difficult to see them closing the gap. And also all of these clubs, I think particularly the ones in Europe, feel that the current system is unsustainable, either because it's been inflated by their own spending, their own mismanagement, but also like trying to keep up with the Joneses, which is the Premier League, which is a league that makes a hell of a lot more money, where the bottom club will make probably the same in domestic TV revenue as a Juventus, as a Milan, as an Inter. And then you've got the spending that we've seen from Man City and Paris Saint-Germain, over the last decade, and they've tried to keep up. And it's very difficult to do that. And I think they feel that there is a real need for a paradigm shift, and they want more stability in a more rational system. I think it was very interesting what you said about picking up on what they said in the statement about women's football and growing that. Clearly that is an area of growth. It needs to be developed. But I think football clubs on the continent, to some extent, don't want to have to choose between we need to pay 8 million to this striker or for this striker in the hope that he gets us into the Champions League so we can get the Champions League money. They have to make a choice between doing that and, say, investing in infrastructure for their women's team, in infrastructure in other areas. They don't want to have to make that call. I think they felt that with that infrastructure grant that they were getting, for what, 300, 350 million, and being in that competition for 23 years, having guaranteed revenue, they could plan and invest. But of course, I don't think they've made that case. They haven't made that case very well. They've just come across for what I think certainly a large element of this Super League thing was, which is kind of greed and power grabbing.
Yeah, well, James, all those you know, all those people leaving this dust planet in a hurry might be looking curiously at the one spaceship coming the other way, landing and depositing Jose Mourinho into the middle of all this. He is the new, or he will be the new Roma manager for next season. Now, in fairness, he achieved one of his great managerial feats in Italy and in the Champions League that season with Inter Milan. Would Roma fans remember that version of Jose Mourinho, or have they been paying any attention to the Premier League over the last four or five seasons?
Well, I this is just amazing, I think, because you know, you have new owners coming at Roma who don't say much, and this is their first appointment, and I do wonder with new owners from the States or from wherever, you know, whether with someone like Jose Mourinho, who transcends his sport, who is a celebrity in some respects, who you just kind of associate with success because you don't have to know much about football or anything about football to know who Jose Mourinho is, and they've appointed him. Amazingly, in their statement, pointing, yeah, okay, to the trophies that he's won, but also to their belief that he is the guy to lead a long-term project.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh there.
No, but I think even if you are the biggest Jose Mourinho fan and believe that he's not finished and that he can still deliver trophies, the idea that he's someone to lead a long-term project. I mean, even in his heyday, you know, the longest period he ever had at a club was what, 3 years. And his tenures have got shorter and shorter, and he's been sacked from Spurs, from United, from Chelsea. You know, the thing is, Roma have you know, they've got these kind of old Premier League sort of stars, I suppose, some of whom worked under him. I wouldn't say had the best periods of their career working under him. We had Mkhitaryan, Smalling, Davide Santon, who, to be honest, probably doesn't play all that much, but he's there in the periphery at Roma. You know, Dzeko, these guys know what Jose Mourinho is about. So you've got them on the one hand, and then you've got all these kind of young players that Roma have invested in. Like the American owners signed this American fullback from Dallas, who they, you know, I think they really want to see him play. They wanted the current coach to use him more, Paulo Fonseca. He's called Brian Reynolds. Yeah, are we confident that Jose Mourinho is the right person to develop sort of young talent? But again, in Italy, it's like, wow, this makes our league relevant again in the way that having Cristiano Ronaldo, Zlatan and Frank Ribery there does. You know, it attracts attention. It makes people want to talk about it. And yet, All of these guys are at stages in their careers where they are past their prime. They're maybe not done, but they're not building the reputation that they had. You know, they're trading on that reputation in some respects. So, look, I think if he wins a trophy at Roma, given that they haven't won one since 2008, very similar circumstances to Spurs, then it will be seen as a success. But it will come at considerable expense. And, you know, I mean, Ken mentioned the Milan clubs and how much money they've been losing. I mean, Roma lost, I think, 204 million for the financial year of last season. They've played another season without fans. They missed out on the Champions League again. So they won't make maybe as bad a loss, but it won't be much. It won't be much improved. And that's even before Jose Mourinho's arrived. So, you know, I mean, I'm not expecting Jose Mourinho to go through the academy and say, look, I like this player, I like that player. We're going to build around these guys. Don't buy me any players. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. All right, James, that's a euphemism, I think. Listen, brilliant stuff. Great to talk to you again. Thanks a mil.
Pleasure. Cheers, guys.
Yo, I'm getting ready to put y'all up on something, man. Yo, put some respect. Put some respect on my name. I've won five World Cups.
It's personal between me and I'm going to give you some serious ammo, you big stiff idiot.
Okay, all right.
who are the people who are going to get together and go, ugh. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yo. Are Kante and Rudiger going to be like, ugh. Azpilicueta and Jorginho? Like, ugh. Little pack of alpha dogs. Like, ugh. Is Mason Mount the senior man? Ugh. My people like, yo, nitro, 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 nitro. Like, ugh. Who's it? Who've we got here? You know? Ugh. He thinks he's the dogs. Ugh. He thinks he's all that. Ugh.
We're live on Channel 5. Alright, go on, one more. Also, they're gonna need 10 plumbers to do you when I've got to finish with you. Also, you are getting it.
So you're the Roma owners, you're looking for a manager who can come in and be part of a long-term project, a manager to bring through the promising young players. I know who we go for, Jose. That's one decision, I suppose. I mean, there are other managers out there, but Jose Mourinho is the one they've gone for. Somewhat surprising in that, in those circumstances, I would have said.
Can you imagine how happy Jose Mourinho must have been to take that phone call? I mean, it's like, it's just a consequence-free existence he's leading now, you know? It's like, what is the absolute worst that could happen here? That I get sacked again and get paid more millions of euro for doing the same job that I've been doing now for the last 4 or 5 years?
I am different. The rules for me are different.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
It is actually an unbelievable existence he has now. Does he have the best life in football?
I prefer really not to speak.
Yeah.
Best life in football.
No, I don't know. I mean, you see, the thing is, like, I just feel as though, you say, like, imagine how happy he would have been. I don't think he would have been happy. Even though he obviously should have been, but I mean, that's sort of the tragedy at this point, you know? Because he's, it's like James the Horncastle said, like, he's the one spaceship arriving on the dust planet. You know, everyone else is scrambling to leave. And here comes Jose. To Alderaan in search of a new a new life, and you know, for a new start. And it's just like, I wouldn't want to be part of any club that would have me as a member problem. And unfortunately, Serie A is the only league that will have Jose as a member, the biggest league that will have him as a member. And consequently, he must despise it with every fiber of his being, even as he goes out there and tries to smile and pretend that he's happy.
Well, listen, in the next couple of weeks alone on the Second Captain's World Service, we're going to have a brand new episode of The Game That Changed My Life, as mentioned earlier, of the Player's Chair, Richie's Player's Chair, Ken's Politics Podcast. That's all in the next couple of weeks alone, and loads more besides. So if you feel like signing up for some of that and for daily episodes of the Second Captain's Podcast, please do it on secondcaptains.com right now. We'll see the rest of you tomorrow. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Kieran.
Bye-bye.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.